shifting schedule.
Don't touch me.
I call the House Committee on Healthcare to order. And this is not a April Fool's Day trick. We're actually here. And Representative Clem has come out of a sick bed to be here to vote on a couple of things, and we appreciate that.
Food poisoning never hurt anybody.
Don't sit too close to the other committee members.
Yeah.
I will announce we're carrying over House Bill 2611 until Wednesday. And when we open up the bill on House Bill 2056, we have decided the bill goes from here to the Revenue Committee. We're dividing up our work. We'll be dealing with the policy issues, why we're doing it, and get reports on the compromise of the group that put it together. But we won't be dealing with the issue of the exemption of long-term care facilities. CCRs, that will be handled in the Revenue Committee perhaps as early as Thursday morning. So we'll be limiting testimony on the bill itself and its substance, and not whether various continuous care communities are included in the assessment. That's on 2056. So if that helps, your scheduling, there we are. I'm going to open a... Well, which way are we going here today? We're going to start with... I'm going to open a public hearing, a work session on House Bill 2123, and ask Representative Bailey to join us. Oh, one other thing. The hearing on House Bill 2897, we're going to have a work session on that, not a public hearing, a work session only for the purpose of sending that bill to Ways and Means. We have the co-chair here to catch it and to carry it over to the Ways and Means Committee, along with some other stuff you want to do today. Representative Bailey, will you? Mr. Administrator, will you talk to us about this bill, please?
House Bill 2123 with the DAC's six amendments requires licensure from the State Board of Pharmacy to act as pharmacy benefit manager. It requires the board to establish rules for obtaining and renewing license. It allows the board to refuse to issue, renew, suspend, or revoke a PBM license for specified conduct. It imposes limits on audits of pharmacies, limits what drugs can be placed on the maximum allowable cost list, requires PBMs disclose sources informing their MAC list to network pharmacies, and establish process for a network pharmacy to request adjustment of MAC pricing.
Thank you. Mr. Bailey, will you introduce this for us, and will you tell us what the amendments we consider the DAC 6, is that right?
Please, yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jules Bailey, proud to represent House District 42. Thank you for bringing this bill up for a work session today. You may recall from the previous public hearing that we had that there were several amendments to this bill. The Dash 6 amendment combines several of those amendments together into one amendment and makes a few tweaks, which I'll describe. Although I'm very happy to report that with the Dash 6 amendment, all of the national PBMs support April Fool, sorry.
That was not bad.
But
C+?
in reality, Mr. Chair, I do want to say thank you to some of the PBM industry representatives who have been willing to engage in discussion on this. I think it's fair to say that there was an attempt to put forward an amendment on their part that did not get us there. We think the Dash 6s are ready to go, but have pledged that as this bill moves through the Ways and Means process, we'll keep the lines of communication open and have an additional meeting on Friday to see if we can come to a little bit more of an agreement. But I believe that the Dash 6 amendments to 2123 make this a good bill, make it ready to go, and really accomplish what this bill is intended to do. As you heard in the public hearing, the Dash 6 amendments do essentially three categories of things. One, we're looking for a licensing with the Board of Pharmacy to know who's doing business and how to get a hold of them in the state of Oregon. This is not the broader transparency initiatives that you've heard about from some other states. It's simply a registration process. Two, there are revised auditing provisions that help protect pharmacies from abusive and unfair audit practices while maintaining their ability, the PBM's ability to audit for truly fraudulent issues and to make sure that those are taken care of. And then three, the MAC pricing provision now brings these provisions more in line with what's happened in other states, modified, of course, for the Oregon context, but in line with what's happened in North Dakota. And I'm pleased to report to you, since we last discussed this in front of the committee, Kentucky has also moved forward on a PBM bill as well. So once again, Oregon is right in the national stream of things. We also have some additional amendments within the bill that are contained within the Dash 6 that take care of an issue with Kaiser and that take care of an issue with Oregon Health Authority to clarify that those are essentially different entities, different animals than what we're trying to regulate here. So I have some additional details, but with the Dash 6 amendments, I believe this bill is ready to be worked and ready to get on down to Ways and Means. We'd be pleased to have your support. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Can we have an amendment on the Dash 6?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 6 amendments dated 3/22/13.
Is there any discussion on the Dash 6? Representative Thompson, I do want to comment about how you've done some hard work with Representative Bailey on getting this thing in shape. Now you have to decide whether you're willing to take the credit for it.
That's true. No, I just wanted to put on the record that this has been a long process in the interim, and Representative Bailey and myself and others put a lot of long hours in on this. And I share with him a kind of question mark that I wish it were more perfect. There's some things that need to be done. I'm extremely pleased that you're having that meeting on Friday, because I think that, you know, we can get some of that done yet. For where we are now, there's a lot of good stuff in this bill. And some of the PBM stuff that we have not been able to get concurrence on isn't that far away. And I'm hoping that you'll continue to push that, and I'll continue to help you do that.
Thank you for all your work, Representative. Appreciate it. Didn't want to hurt you there, but really appreciate all the hard work you put in.
No, you've done a great job. So.
Is there any more discussion on the Dash 6? Yes. Is it on the amendment or on the whole thing?
This is on the amendment as it deals with MAC pricing. Could you maybe understand what the difference would be between the current practice, which I, you know, just to set the context, I mean, I understand that it is a cost-saving measure from the view of the PBM and its customers, as the case may be, but it seems just incredibly oppressive to a pharmacy, especially small pharmacies. And so I thought that was a difficult issue. I was curious to hear maybe a little bit more detail about what the Dash 6 does to that.
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, Representative Conger, it's a great question. And I would characterize it from a high-level perspective at first to say we are definitely trying to walk a line here while preserving what I think has the potential to be a cost savings, as you describe, but keeping it still a tool that small pharmacies can work with, right? You got to be able to know what the cost of something is putting out the door when you put it out the door. So what we're trying to do is say, not say that there can't be best practices around modifying MAC pricing, around changing that in a way that reflects market conditions, but rather making sure that pharmacies know what the costs are and that they have some certainty around what it is when they put it out the door. We also modified the provision. It came up in testimony before. I believe it's taken care of in the Dash 6 is there was an unintentional drafting that put a more narrow definition of generics in the previous version. This, I believe, addresses that issue. Under the MAC section, essentially the PBM has to provide notice of sources used to determine MACs and MAC lists to each network pharmacy at the beginning and renewal of contract, and it can't set MAC below cost in the source document. So there's also updates the list at least once every 7 business days and provides notification of what changes have happened to the pharmacy. There's some provisions around retroactivity as well too to help protect pharmacies from retroactive MAC price changes. So.
Thank you. So there is an advance notice then, at least of some period of time, that the pharmacy would know what the new pricing would be before writing the prescription.
Mr. Chair, Representative Conger, yes, that's okay. The intention.
Within the week. It could have happened within the week.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other on
Mr. Chair?
Dash 6? Yes.
Real quick, thank you, Representative Bailey, for being here with us today. Just wondering if any discussion came up, because I've had issues with our pricing on pharmaceuticals in general because of the rebate schemes, everything that goes on. And I'm wondering, did you try to get at that at all? I'm going through the Dash 6s. Sorry, this is the first time I got a look at them or a chance to go through them. But because one of the things, these guys are getting rebates. So we're paying a fill rate of $9, $10, $15. Then they're buying the drug, and they could be getting a rebate back from the drug supplier as well, even though there's a MAC pricing in place. And this is a big problem that I have with all these different hands in the pie that drives the cost up, when we can send people to Walmart and they can get the same thing for $4 and we don't have to pay a fill rate. So I'm wondering if you attempted to get after that at all in this? Was that your intent in the Staff 6 Amendment, or where are we at?
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, that's a really excellent point, and it's something that's come up in discussions, especially the issue around rebates. I have to confess that that's not really addressed within the Dash 6s. That issue came up and was discussed in the interim work group. There didn't seem to be a really clean way to get at that issue in this particular bill. It actually would have been addressed in the original PBM bill that this committee saw last session to some degree, but I think that gets into contractual issues of PBM business practices, which I am more than happy to continue the discussion around that issue. This particular bill, because of its scope, is a little bit narrower than that issue, but you've put your finger on something that's incredibly important, and I would hope that we continue to have discussions around that. Representative,
yes, sir.
I was just going to say.
Chair Bailey.
Yeah.
Chair Bailey.
One of the issues that we discussed around this, and one of the stumbling points that needs a whole lot more more care, is if you write a bill that takes on the PBMs, sets standards for their income and expenses, checks them on which rebates they get and how much they have to declare on those rebates, and a lot of other things that are kind of draconian, then all you have to do is take out PBMs and you can put in grocery stores or hospitals or any other business entity. So the question was, to what extent can we step into this realm and write legislation prescribing and proscribing business activities that aren't illegal without having it go over to the next business? And pretty soon, we're setting profit margins at the legislative level for any and all businesses operating in Oregon. And that might not be a good idea.
Should I have a couple nominees for that?
Yeah.
We increase mine.
That's a comment.
The issue came up on insurance companies as another example. If we could put, really set a standard for PBMs, then we'll roll this over. We'll do insurance companies next, which are already under incredible scrutiny. But
maybe hospitals too.
Yeah, but so it's a slippery slope. We want to be real careful what we're doing against our intents.
Any other comments on the Dash 6? Any objection to the Dash 6? They're part of the bill. Do we have a motion on the bill now?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2123 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves House Bill 2123 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion on the bill?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'll be voting no, because I don't think this truly gets at the whole problem that we're dealing with here. Just so Ways and Means takes a much deeper look at this, because we have a much bigger issue or problem that we're dealing with here. And I don't think we're actually at the consumer level to where we should be. So where guys negotiate price and where they are, I think there's too many games that are going on here.
I mean, I take exception to what you said, because the co-chair is here. I hope Ways and Means doesn't deal with policy on this, but hopes they deal with the fiscal stuff. They have enough to do with that. Although I know they have trouble not meddling in what's going on. I think if this bill needs further work, we should take it up in the interim and move it where it needs to go and take it back up as a policy discussion in the next session. Which I agree with your concept.
I think we've created the problem by getting involved with it is part of the situation we're dealing with.
Often happens. Any other discussion on the motion? Debbie, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Klim?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Kenner?
Aye.
Representative Lightley?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Kitty Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee.
Aye. Motion carries. House Bill 2123 is off to Ways and Means. Did you bring a big box to carry them back with you?
Thank you very much for your work.
I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2123 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2445 and ask Representative Buckley and Representative Nathanson with us as well. She's next door testifying, is that right?
It's going to be close.
Sure. Should we move on or should we just hold on a minute? Sanities? Okay. Well, let's leave that public hearing open and move to, where is the one we want to just move on to Ways and Means? Yeah. Maybe we can have you talking while we're waiting. I'd like to open up a work session on 2897 on the autism spectrum bill, only for the purpose of moving into Ways and Means. But while you're here, I'd really appreciate you talking just a bit about what you're going to do with it when it gets there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County in the legislature. And Mr. Chair, members, this bill before you is one that many of you have seen in previous sessions. I've been trying since 2007 to get some forward motion on the coverage of applied behavior analysis for children with autism in the state of Oregon. A number of other states have moved in this direction with good results. And I think the controversy around the bill, around the concept, is that it works for a good number of kids. It doesn't work for every kid. But the fact that it does work for a good percentage of kids, to me, makes it imperative that we actually make use of this tool in our state. In the past sessions, we found votes for this bill in committee, and we have not been able to find funding for it in Ways and Means, which grates me a great deal. It bothers me a great deal. Because this is so vital for families with children with autism, to have the treatment available at an early age and to give these kids the best chance possible to have a life of independence, I think is something we're called to do. Here's a tool before us to get it done. The cost incurred, at least from the state part, has to do with the Oregon Health Plan and PEB. And we'd be paying for that for any increased cost for this care. Other states have found this to be not a tremendous increase in cost, but there is an increase in cost that has to be factored in to the budget and to insurance rates as well. So it's something that we don't take lightly in any way, but it's an important issue. I'm asking you, if you would, with your consideration, to send to Ways and Means so we have it there to work with. Senator Bates is working with advocates and insurance companies on the Senate side, hoping to get a compromise, a workable solution, both on the insurance side and for the families as well. I'm cautiously optimistic we'll be able to get something done this session. So with your consideration, Mr. Chair, I'd love to get it down there.
You might have both bills with the ability to put them together.
That's right.
Good. Thank you. Is there any questions, Representative Buckley?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair.
Go for it.
Well, just want to say thank you for your tenacity.
Thank you. It's important. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do we have a motion? Let's put a motion on the floor and we can discuss the motion.
one real quick. Does this add, if we go forward, does this add to the insurance mandate list for Oregon, and how does that play out with the federal health care law?
Representative, this would be a mandate.
Okay.
That this would add this treatment to what we do.
Well, let me comment on that. There's, in the essential benefit package, where we're talking about in the exchange, there's something called habilitation services, which is sort of the opposite of rehabilitation services. There was a request from the federal government to determine whether autism spectrum disorder treatment would be in the essential benefit package under that term, and the decision was not to make a decision. So I think that left it to us to determine whether we wanted this as a part of the essential benefit package under the exchange or not. And that may get into that discussion. I don't think that this bill solves that problem, does it?
I don't believe so, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just real quick walking through this. I'm just wondering, will this pick up the tab for some of the stuff that the ESDs and the schools are doing with the children at this point right now, or will insurance be required to pay for some of the stuff that's going on?
Chair Greenleaf, so it will not change that dynamic in the financial equation, other than that if families are able to access care through their private insurance policies, it should be able to add additional hours of treatment for their children. ESDs and our current early childhood special education programs can provide services. A constant complaint and concern from families is that their child is not offered enough hours of treatment through early childhood services in order to actually have the impact that the treatment is capable of doing so. So, again, my view of where we are with early child special education, early intervention, is we're not there yet in terms, or anywhere close to the terms of the hours we should be providing for kids. This, to me, would be additional hours that a child might be able to receive.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. The only reason I bring it up is my wife actually works for the ESD in autism classroom, so they have the children 5 days a week, and I was just wondering if this might be something that alleviate the for the school districts. But you're saying above and beyond the 6 or 7 hours that they have these children, so this would add like Saturday and Sunday, where they wouldn't, any work that they needed done then would be covered under insurance.
Mr. Representative, it would be entirely up to what the treatment program was for the individual child. But in when we've done the discussions on this in the past, there are families who strongly believe, and families that had success with multiple hours of treatment each week, far beyond what's available to the ESDs.
Okay. Do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2897 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves that House Bill 2897 be passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation and referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any further discussion on this? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I very much appreciate the intent of the bill, and I had the experience of meeting a constituent whose son had this treatment, and had gone in the course of a couple of years from completely nonverbal to very, very high functioning. So obviously a one of the kids who was squarely in the intent of this training and the bill that we're considering, because of the incredible, I would say almost miraculous result for that child and that family. I think it's very, very difficult for me, because philosophically I feel like we, with the best of intentions, we mandate too much. And what we're doing, obviously, in the aggregate is we are creating a lot of cost and passing it on, either directly in the form of higher costs for the state or indirectly in the form of higher costs for consumers of health insurance. To me, it's interesting, if we had a system that truly valued the long-term costs of health care, if we knew how to design a perfect health care system so that financial incentives aligned with results, then the long-term cost for this child that I met would be significantly less, and the financial justification would be easily factored in now, the return on investment in that child's health, setting aside for a moment the human implications of him being able to live a life, you know, potentially as a basically a normal child versus someone who was very, very impacted by autism. So, and his family. So it's a difficult vote. I'm going to vote in favor of the bill. I appreciate Representative Buckley's advocacy, and I just hope that in the long run, some of the work that we're doing will end up saving money and having that benefit as well.
We have two heroes in the building on this one. Both Representative Buckley and Senator Edwards have been carrying the torch on this now for 6 years, eight years for some time.
Mr. Chairman. If I could, I'd just like to add one more thing. When we talked about this bill earlier, I had mentioned I have a grandson who's essentially was nonverbal 3 months ago. And on Easter Sunday, he gave his first sentence. It was a pretty neat one. It was, wow. Mommy, I love you. So, the treatment works.
That's using this treatment.
That's
well,
very impressive.
Some variations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the problem. Okay. Call the roll, please.
Representative Klein?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Hennemer?
Aye.
Representative Wigley?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Dyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
And Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion carries. House Bill 2897 on its way to Ways and Means. All right, let's see.
Hear yet.
Okay, then we'll move on to House, close the work session on House Bill 2897 and open the work session on House Bill 3458 and ask Laura Colley, Tom Holt, and Betsy Earls to come and join us and talk about, I think, the great work that's been done by folks working on this bill.
All right. Get started.
Please.
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, my name is Laura Colley. I'm the Chief Actuary for the Insurance Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and we are here again to talk about House Bill 3458, and just a brief reminder of what the bill does. It provides reinsurance payments that wrap around the federal reinsurance program for the individual market, the individual health benefit plan market, and it's intended to provide additional premium relief in the initial years of implementation of the Affordable Care Act. And since we first came and presented the bill, we've had a number of amendments really focused on just clarifying a number of things and cleaning up the language, no substantive changes to the structure or how it will operate. And I was just going to run through some of the key amendments and then allow you to ask any questions.
Are they all in the dash twos?
They're all in the dash twos, yes.
Okay.
Some of the key changes was that we clarified the definition of the reinsurance eligible individual. So it clarifies that the individual must be enrolled on either OMIP, portability, or children's reinsurance reinsured plans as of December 31st, 2013. Requires that coverage be secured in the individual market by April 1, 2014, and that the coverage must be issued in the state. So also clarifies the board's authority to make adjustments to the payment parameters once they've been set in rule, that only uniform adjustments across the industry can be made to reduce the coinsurance rate if there's a shortfall in funding. No other changes once they've been established in rule. We removed the linkages to the federal program in terms of the wording. It wasn't necessary, and it just allows for a little more flexibility in rulemaking. There's clarification that the assessment must be sufficient to pay for administrative costs and the projected reinsurance payments, and so that the parameters must be set within the boundaries of those assessments. And there's also adjustments throughout the bill just to replace instances of OMIP with the reinsurance program to clarify that the treatment of the two programs in terms of the assessments is the same. There's also an adjustment to clarify the insurers that are subject to the assessment base. So it's identical to the assessment base that currently pays the OMIP assessment. And it also clarifies that excess funding at the end of the program, the end of the 3 years, will be returned to the issuers who pay the assessment on a pro rata basis once all the claims have been paid. There is also a requirement that insurers' rate filings reflect both the impact of the state assessment as well as the state reinsurance payments in their annual rate filings, and so that will be part of the rate review process. And finally, there's an expansion to the board from 10 members to 12 members, and two of those members are to be members of the business committee.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom Holt with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, here in support of the Dash 2s. It's nice to be able to be in support of a bill in front of your committee. Laura's done a nice job of summarizing the changes made in the Dash 2. I just want to underscore a couple of things. One, that those who would be subject to the assessment for the reinsurance program that's proposed here would be the same people who are subject to the assessment under OMIP. So some of those who have been worried that they might be brought into this who are not now part of this need not worry. They are not. We've taken care of that with the language. There were also some questions about what authority would the board have to adjust the assessment. And the way that this amendment is written, the only direction the board can take the assessment is down. And that was an important criteria to get the support of those who ultimately pay for this through their premiums. And then just the last thing I wanted to touch on, and we really appreciate your promptness allowing us to bring this bill forward. It's a project we started in early December, late November, when it became clear in the federal rules that this would be something allowable for the state. It's been a fairly intensive process, but we are now at a point where actuaries are putting the final cross T's and dots I's in their rate filings that are going to be submitted to Laura's division at the end of this month. And so once this gets to the next step of the process, it is imperative that it continue to move quickly so that we have it formally approved before those rates are submitted. And we appreciate the attention that you've put on this, sir, and the committee's attention and the speed with which that you've considered it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries. AOI has worked on the reinsurance proposal, this embodied in House Bill 3458, since late fall, and it has been a lot of discussion around how the state was going to deal with the churning that perhaps would take place in the individual market and maybe seeping up into the small group market as the ACA phased in. So we think that 3458 is a reasonable response to the concern that we have about that shifting as ACA phases in, and we support the bill as it's written and amended. One thing I would point out to you is that we support this bill on the contingency that the 1% premium tax for healthy kids sunsets as it is scheduled to do. So our position is that 3458, fills in kind of where the 1% premium tax left off, and we can afford to pay that in order to smooth the way into the future, but the business community is not able to afford a continuation of the 1% premium tax and a 3458 assessment on top of that.
But you're losing the OMIP assessment, is that right, and the portability assessment? And the one...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So yes, the OMIP assessment is expected to sunset, as is the children's reinsurance assessment. And when the technical group that took up the issue of the reinsurance program started this, I think I may have mentioned this, but it's been a little bit of time since we talked about it first. But we started with the ceiling of the current level of assessment that exists in the market, and included in that ceiling was the 1%. premium tax. So that was part of the group's discussion in terms of understanding what the current level of assessment was and then moving from that, you know, what exists today to what would exist under a reinsurance program.
And does this bill bring you to that ceiling? Or my impression was it's a bit less than that ceiling.
Mr. Chair, yes,
it is. Everybody will drop your insurance rates and make businesses happy. Is that right, Mr. Holt?
Mr. Chair, I think it's been a while since we first talked about this bill in front of the committee, but the two big pieces, I mean, there was there were a couple of smaller assessments, but the two big pieces that we see making up the rate right now are the federal assessment that is also new and that will be member. Right, so that's $5.25.
Right. Forgot that.
And that is going to take up the bulk of the rest of the space.
So it's about a break even, though. Is that your calculations between this?
It's a little less.
Yeah, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, it's a slightly less in total assessment. But in answer to your question, yes, we expect to reflect this program in our rates. And the big benefit of this is that in the individual market especially, it will mitigate the amount of rate that we'll be needing to ask for from the division. So it's a reduce the rate of increase kind of measure rather than a... Unfortunately, it's unlikely we'll be able to reduce from today's rates.
I obviously meant that.
We wish we could.
Okay. Are there any questions in the panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do we have a motion on this?
We do. Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3458, dated 3/28/13.
Representative Thompson moves the Dash 2 amendments, dated 3/28/13, be added to House Bill 3858. Is there any discussion? It's basically a gut and stuff, right?
3458.
I'm sorry, 3458. Was there some discussion? No? Okay. Is there any objection to the Dash 2s? Dash 2s are a part of 3458. Do we have an amendment on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3458 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
We're turfing a lot of stuff today, aren't we? Yeah. Representative Thompson moves House Bill 3458 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? I just want to comment. I think you guys did a great job on this. It was not an easy thing, and it was a big group of folks who worked very hard, including the governor's staff and DCBS. So, good job. Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Klim?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Excused.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Kinnamer?
Aye.
Representative Wigley?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Excuse.
Vice Chair Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
And Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion carries. House Bill 3458 on its way to Ways and Means with our blessings. Close the work session on House Bill 3458. Do we have...
Everybody's here.
Okay. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2445 and ask our representatives, Nathanson. Did we lose Representative Buckley? No, we didn't. Good. Can you introduce the bill for us, Mr. Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2445... with the Dash 4 amendments, requires Oregon Health Authority to adopt by rule certification criteria for school-based health care centers. It requires the Health Authority to convene work groups to recommend best practices. It authorizes the Health Authority to contract with an entity that coordinates school-based health center care. It defines school-based health centers as a health clinic on school grounds providing primary preventive behavioral and oral health care and health education services through licensed certified health professionals or students enrolled in professional medical nursing or dental program. It requires the health authority to provide stable, consistent, predictable funding for school-based health centers requires the health authority to create a pool of funds to increase the number of health centers which access patient-centered primary care facilities without requiring certification and improve delivery and coordination of care. It requires the health authority to reimburse school-based health centers on fee-for-service basis for medical assistance program-covered services not reimbursed by a care organization. It allows grants and funding for school-based health centers from health systems fund.
And we have some amendment, which means you're not ready to work this bill, even though it just goes to Ways and Means today. Is that right? Have at it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, State Representative from District 13. I'm very pleased to be here with you today and with my colleague, Representative Buckley, to give you a new sort of comprehensive approach on ramping up our efforts to assist school-based health centers. The role of school health clinics in the healthcare continuum is recognized by education and healthcare professionals and organizations as diverse as the Northwest Health Foundation and the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. I'd like to read you just a few points that are published by the Oregon Health Authority with regard to SBHCs. They provide easily accessible physical, mental, and preventive health services. They keep parents from missing work to take students to healthcare elsewhere. Perhaps the most important is this statement, quote, school-based health centers, SBHCs, are an important part of achieving the state's healthcare transformation goals, end quote. When kids aren't well, they can't learn up to their potential. They miss school. They go untreated. There's a cost to the education system. It's discouraging in how it affects their ability to learn, and it impacts the cost of health care overall because they end up with more costly treatment or in an emergency department sometimes. As the OHA puts it, quote, the relationship between health and learning is clear and well established. Physical, mental, or social, emotional health problems can impede class time, student assistance, and student ability to fully engage in learning. Just two ways, specific examples I'd like to point out. Youth depression is linked with low academic achievement, and asthma that isn't controlled well leads to higher rates of absenteeism. So what are we doing to help these school-based health centers in Oregon, given that we know how important they are? Thank you, Mr. Chair, for mentioning that there's a -4 amendment. It incorporates the best ideas for fine-tuning language as we've worked with many of the people who are interested in moving this forward. And I would like to mention that there, we hope, will be a -5 amendment to do some even more fine-tuning of language as we read over the details of this, referring to the Oregon Health Authority, talking about the most appropriate ways of reimbursing or paying for services and so forth.
Will the -5s include the -4s?
Yes. Yes, we'd like to do just one to make available to you. About two-thirds of Oregon's counties have a certified school-based health center. For example, Umatilla, Union, and Baker in northeast Oregon, Deschutes, Crook, and Wheeler in central Oregon, the five southwest Oregon counties, and all but three counties west of the Cascades. Some operate through FQHCs, some do not. Most, but not all, are closely connected and have a medical sponsor. All should be working in concert with their CCO, but they're not yet. In this bill, several of us legislators, Representatives Buckley and Reardon and I, are taking a few steps forward to help support and shape SBHCs, including funding and scope of responsibility. We want them to operate as cost-effectively as possible, using best practices for healthcare as well as best practices for business. Most of all, we want to help them continue and thrive. Some clinics are in jeopardy due to either funding or regulatory pressures. My hope is that through these, the language that we would adopt in this bill, we will help encourage, support, and amplify the work of school clinics. Let's be sure our approach to funding and certification ensures that they continue to improve and ensures that they continue to thrive and doesn't discourage them so that they start to wither. Thank you.
Thank
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I'm Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County in the legislature. I'm very happy to be here with my colleague, Representative Nathanson. I'm here primarily because whatever Representative Nathanson asks me to do, I try to do because it's just good policy.
We all do.
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Nathanson gave the overview. The bill that is going to be before you with the Dash 5s is a combination of all the different ideas from Representatives and Senator Steiner Hayward, who are trying to see what we could do to make sure at this crucial time as we're developing the CCOs, that school-based health centers, what would be a clear part of that work. When the CCO concept was first brought to me, my first time I haven't read about it, the first thing that threw my head was, oh, well, this is what La Clinica does in Jackson County, because La Clinica works with school-based health centers. La Clinica basically has that kind of flexible care, the kind of like whatever is needed to get the care is what has to happen. And La Clinica was my introduction to school-based health centers, not only working with the local school-based health centers to make sure that students had access to care, but going so far to set up a volunteer program where parents would volunteer to show up at the school at 3 o'clock, put kids in their cars, and drive them to the dental clinic to make sure the kids got dental care. Well, you know, not their own kids, the kids, any of the kids that are at school that had to get to the dental clinic. This idea of bringing health care to where the students are makes so much sense, and it's so vital, I think, to the very idea behind the CCOs of making sure we get the best care at the least cost and the best outcome. Your committee has been central to the development of the entire idea of CCOs. I'm sure this is not news to you how vital a piece these school-based health centers can be. We put together a number of ideas with this legislation, and we'll with your assistance, we'll move it forward and see which parts of it can get funded and put in place. But it was our view that it was crucial to act at this time while the CCO model is being developed to make sure that school-based health centers are central part of it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And when we send it to Ways and Means, it won't be to tinker with the policy. It will be to find out where you can get money for whatever you can get money for. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, any tinkering would be done in consultation with yourself and any other policy chair that might be involved.
You missed an earlier dialogue.
I did hear that, Mr. Chair.
Are there any questions to this group? We've got some public folks as well.
Does this bill either encourage or discourage school-based health clinics working with CCOs?
Please go ahead.
The point is to encourage closer collaboration with CCOs.
Good. I have some concerns about setting up extra veins of funding in healthcare that we can't afford.
No.
But, yeah.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'm a huge supporter of school-based health clinics, so happy to be discussing this. I'm just curious about, I'm assuming that Medicaid patients have gotten fee-for-service through the school-based health clinics in the past, that they've been reimbursed, the school-based health clinics have been reimbursed that way, and that you're wanting to carry this on until the CCO
some have,
gets worked
but not
out?
All.
Not all? So some people who are eligible for Medicaid services got served in school-based health clinics that were not reimbursed by Medicaid?
Some school-based health clinics didn't have mechanisms for billing.
So I'm curious, like, what has it been and what we're going to, and then, you know, and the CCOs would keep trying to get away from fee-for-service and toward an integrated model. I can imagine this probably comes about because, for instance, in Multnomah County, you have two different CCOs, one school-based health clinic, and children could come from, you know, whose families might be different. But I'm just curious about what it's been, what you're proposing now, where you ultimately see it going.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, one of the language changes that we hope will be included in a Dash 5 amendment will be yet some more fine-tuned wording about this reimbursement issue. But yes, it's there are some that have received payments, some that have not, but they're still operating, trying to take care of all the kids as best they can. You are going to hear testimony in a few minutes from the representative director of Oregon School-Based Healthcare Network, who will have much more specific information for you on funding and reimbursements and so forth. But our aim is to lift all school-based health centers and make sure that reimbursements will be adequate so that they can continue taking care of children, as Representative Buckley said, in the most cost-effective way, which is the least cost and where they are at school.
Okay, well, let's hear from them. Thank you very much for introducing this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have Paula Hester and Doug Riggs. Please join us now. And then the last panel will be Jim Torrey, Jeffrey Stewart, and Bill Thomas.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Doug Riggs on behalf of the Oregon School-Based Healthcare Network, and I very much appreciate you taking the time today. I'm going to let Paula go into the details, but I do want to echo a point that was just made by Representative Buckley, which is several bills were introduced, one by Representative Reardon, one by Representative Nathanson, one by Representative Buckley. The House bills are a kind of a compendium of the best ideas from all three bills. There's also a Senate companion bill, Senate Bill 436, which has to do with the exact question that was just asked on how do you integrate as we're going to a new model of care, and not just school-based health centers, but also the programs from the Early Learning Council and the Youth Development Council, and I'm very involved in all those. And if there is not some sort of thoughtful effort to consider how we better integrate these systems over the next 4 or 5 years, we'll have bits and pieces in a variety of locations. That bill, as introduced, is being amended, and we have an amendment for that bill as well. I think the committee here, once it gets here, will like that bill. It goes to a voluntary program with some hopefully some incentive money for those parties to be able to get together, and uses the existing format for a CCO, which is a community health needs assessment, which they already are going to have to do, and then a revision of a transformation plan at some future point to be able to integrate that kind of work. So the goal of both of these bills is not to impose any new burden on CCOs or SBHCs or YDC, ELC people, but to bring them together and hopefully leverage those assets. So I think you'll be excited to see that bill. Hopefully it'll get here in the next few weeks.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Greenlich, Vice Chair Kindergarten and Thompson's and committee members. My name is Paula Hester with the Oregon School-Based Healthcare Network, a nonprofit organization in our state that has advocated for school-based health centers for many, many years. It is a privilege to be here to speak in support of House Bill 2445 today. The legislature has been a long-term friend to school-based health care. Over the last 10 years, nearly 1,000 students have traveled to these halls to tell their stories to legislators. Stories of health and well-being because their center was secure in their community or they were planning a new one. The investment of time and money at the state and local level are profound for these children, most of whom live the unintended consequences of their family's poverty and face a myriad of challenges because of lack of equity and inclusion. This bill authorizes the school-based health center program, which is currently operated by the Oregon Health Authority. It mirrors in many ways what we've been able to have authorized at the federal level for school-based health centers in the last 3 years. So there's really nothing new or exciting other than the authorization piece in the first section. And when it comes to the funding for the school-based health centers, one of the dialogues we've had is how many times we get to come back and tell you how great these centers are, and the kids get to come and tell you how important it is to continue the funding. Let me just remind us that when the state legislature made its initial investment in school-based health centers in 1986, 8 centers existed, and over the course of time, that's now grown to 63 with 4 more in planning stages. So we anticipate these numbers to continue to rise. Additionally, federal government has invested over $7 million in school-based health centers in our state through capital building projects. This bill also calls for increased technical assistance and training to improve the business practices at SBHCs, including billing and reimbursement. And then we do get to the issue around where the dollars are coming from. And so if I could address that for just a second, we have started a preliminary study that will go through the rest of the school year looking at specifically where are the challenges and what's working around relationships between CCOs and the SBHCs. And with 84% of the SBHC systems reporting, meaning, for example, Multnomah County, who manages 12 centers Lane 4J Schools, which manages four, with 84% of those systems responding, 67% report a very defined relationship with their CCO. So I think there's a lot of promise that's out there, and moving all of our centers towards that practice is part of the driving point in this bill. Secondly, 19% of those systems have no contract with these the CCOs, but have a payment mechanism built in through their medical sponsor. And then 14% are not sure what their status is. More than half of the centers are being paid a fee for service from their CCOs. 24% are receiving payment through a capitation agreement. 12% are being treated as specialty providers as opposed to a primary care provider, and 12% reports receiving no payments. And just for your information, for the centers that have become, with regard to primary patient-centered primary care homes, 44% of the SBHCs have received a Tier 1 or Tier 2 recognition, and which means that, gosh, it probably could be done in the other remaining centers. And I think the other issue is just that it drives to Representative Kindergartner's comment about where payments have been received and haven't been in the past. And I have specific examples, not to make anyone look bad, but to think about how this impacts. The state's made these investments in these centers for a long time. And these investments have pulled together communities, school community, provider communities, and in many ways have been able to develop a reasonable cost care for kids right where they live and breathe, if you will, all day long.
Ms. Hester, I hate to do this to you, but I need to hurry it along because we have two other bills.
Yes, sir.
We will specifically bring you back when we go to work session.
Okay.
Ask your comments on the dash sixes
and deal and with
comment
the data
and deal
time.
With any other questions
okay.
that we have.
All right. Well, thank you.
We need to make sure. Well, you'll keep an eye on that. You need to make sure.
Oh, I will.
Please do. Great. Well, let me call the next panel up. Jim Torrey, Jeffrey Stewart, and Bill Thomas, and ask you to keep your comments brief, please. We've got two other bills, including one that has some folks that want to talk about it.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I'm going to make this fast. You've already heard how important school-based health clinics are. I'm not going to read all of the stuff I have here, but I thought it might be very helpful, and I'll leave you a copy of my comments that I was going to give.
Thank you.
I received an email from a doctor in Eugene, Robert Brastick. He's the director of behavioral health services for Peace Health Oregon West Network.
Could you introduce yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Jim Torrey,
and
I'm a member
of
the 4J School Board from Eugene, Oregon.
Nice to see you again.
In any event, I thought I would read you just part of his email to me. Depression is relatively common among school-age students who are then at risk for self-endangering behaviors and suicide. In addition, many students experience varied and even catastrophic stresses in their lives. He is a member of the CCO in Lane County. And he went on to say, I appreciate the challenges around setting up medical homes, EMRs, electronic medical records, and meeting regulatory requirements for these. Peace Health and the Coordinated Care Organization in Lane County are involved with you in helping deal with this issue, and I'll specifically indicate in the case of 4J. It would cost thousands and thousands of dollars for us to be able to implement an appropriately accredited billing system and to meet the requirements of bringing in a federally approved medical home, which includes 24/7 coverage. So I'm going to just say this to you. We, in our district, and I'm sure like all other districts in the state, are looking very carefully at where we use the dollars that we have to provide education for our children. And we're at the point right now where we're looking at closing schools for 10 days next year, increasing class sizes. And one of the things that we're looking at is the possibility of doing away with our 4 mental health counselors in our high schools. None of us want to make these decisions, but the fact is we're at a point where is medical health and mental health such an important part of the education system that we won't fund it. I'm of the opinion it is so important that we're going to have to find offsets in our budget to provide it. And anything you can help us with would be very helpful. We're not qualified yet, and frankly, I don't see it being the appropriate use of our funds to get qualified. I do think, and Representative Thompson, I appreciate your comments. I think there are ways to deal with this. I think we can bring districts together in Lane County and help find a way to be more cost efficient and provide the medical home. I'm not going to go into any more depth. I'm not a doctor. Frankly, I'm just a local person that believes education is so important, and in particular for those kids who are at risk of doing danger to themselves or other students in their classes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Torrey.
Thank you, Chair Greenlich, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Jeffrey Stewart. I'm a member of the faculty of the Oregon Health and Science University School of Dentistry, and I'm here on behalf of OHSU in support of the -4 amendments to House Bill 2445. Though it is not often discussed, there are a lot of unmet dental needs among children in Oregon. Far too many of our children never see a dentist. According to the Centers for Disease Control, Oregon has the 5th highest rate of untreated cavities in children. Poor oral health can be devastating for a child. It can set them back developmentally and academically. And of course, dental decay is entirely preventable. The amendments to House Bill 2445 would include oral health care as a health service that can be provided by school-based health centers. This would help increase access to dental care for Oregon's vulnerable children. The amendments also include students enrolled in medical, dental, and nursing programs at an accredited university like OHSU as an approved provider type to provide care at school-based clinics. If proper supervision is provided, students would have the ability to learn and engage in an important way in these communities. Putting our students in community settings is an integral part of the curriculum at OHSU. In the School of Dentistry, for example, students in their 4th year are required to have community dentistry clinical experiences in rural and underserved areas across Portland and around the state. One such community dentistry opportunity for our students is at the Creston Dental Clinic in southeast Portland. This is a dental clinic located wholly within an elementary school. It has been operating for decades, largely staffed by community dentists who volunteer their time. OHSU has been sending some of our dental students there to help provide oral care for the children of that school. At OHSU, we welcome additional opportunities for our students to provide care to underserved Oregonians, including children in school-based clinics. We have to be sure a given clinical opportunity truly contributes to our students' education as a healthcare provider before requiring them to participate. We must balance our mission to treat patients who might not otherwise receive care with the need to prepare our dental, nursing, and medical graduates to be the best providers they can be. This is why we support the language that allows our students to provide care in school-based health centers but does not require them to do so. OHSU needs to have the flexibility to place students from all our schools in clinical sites that are best for their education while also serving the needs of Oregonians. OHSU supports the inclusion of professional students and the increased emphasis on children's oral health care included in the amendments to House Bill 2445. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I encourage your support for this important legislation.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Chair Greenlich and members of the committee, my name is Bill Thomas. I'm director of the Washington County Commission on Children and Families, and I'm here today to testify on behalf of both our commission and our Department of Health and Human Services. We support 41 or the dash 4 or 5 or 6 amendments to House Bill 2445. Let me get to the point. As Paula testified, there has been a relationship between the state and school-based health centers since 1985 when the legislature appropriated $210,000. It's about time that we codify that relationship and established a statutory framework that made it clear that the state has a continuing intent to support the expansion and continuation of school-based health centers. It's also an appropriate time to provide a statutory framework that not only offers guidance to the Oregon Health Authority to how to accomplish that, but can link together the healthcare transformation and educational reforms that are currently proceeding in a parallel path, but with very little coordination. I'd like to point out that one of the metrics that have been identified for CCOs is adolescent well-child visits, which are now 21%. They are the well-child visits for 0 to 5 or at 55%. School-based health centers clearly provide a major help to coordinated care organizations in terms of reaching adolescents to increase well-child visits. We in Washington County have been very successful over the last 7 years at developing school-based health centers. We've built a broad collaboration. We develop an integrated model of both primary care, mental health, and dental services. We've leveraged over $5.5 million. We've brought in $1.5 million in three federal construction grants, which enabled construction not only of a new center we opened at Century just last month, at Century High School in Hillsboro, but will enable us to open new centers at Beaverton High School and Tualatin High School, which will also serve the students of Sherwood School District. At that point, we'll have a network of school-based health centers that will serve all seven school districts. We believe that that kind of development is possible throughout the state of Oregon. We could not have done that without some assurance that there would be state funding available. We need to, again, have that codified, that commitment to continue to the expansion and support of school-based health centers and to provide that statutory framework that aligns educational reform and healthcare reform. For that reason, we urge your support of the of 2445 with the amendments that Representative Nathanson will be bringing forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And we'll get to, I think we need to move on, but we'll get further discussion on this one when we have the amendments. Thank you very much for coming down, guys. Close the work session on House Bill 2445 and open up, I'm sorry, the public hearing on 2445 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2056 and ask Jim Carlson and Mike McCormick to kick us off, and will you tell us what we're talking about in the meantime?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2056 extends long-term care facility assessment to July 1st, 2020. It authorized the Department of Human Services to take steps to reduce long-term care facility bed capacity statewide by 1,500 beds by December 31st, 2015. It establishes procedures for long-term care facility to purchase bed capacity from another facility and declares legislative intent to exempt activities from state antitrust laws, providing immunity from federal antitrust laws.
I want to point out once again that we're not going to be discussing today the question of whether or not to include the continuous care retirement communities on this bill. That will be taken up in the Revenue Committee as a revenue issue. We're here just to talk about why we're doing this and what impact it will have. Jim, you want to kick it off, or Mike, who's...
Mike? Yep. I'll kick it off. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike McCormick. I'm the Deputy Director for the Aging and People with Disabilities Program within the Department of Human Services. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2056. We began working on this bill with the Oregon Healthcare Association and other stakeholders over a year ago. There was a lot of back and forth between the department and stakeholders on the components of this bill. And some of the findings which influence the content of this bill is a 2012 AARP study of nursing facility occupancy across all 50 states. Out of all 50 states, Oregon has the lowest occupancy rate in the nation. At the time, it was reported at 63%. It's even lower now that we have newer data. It's below 61% occupancy. And this is an issue because the inefficiency of the nursing facility operations causes increased costs to the state. Due to the way that the nursing facility reimbursement rate is promulgated in statute. So we work together with the industry to figure out what does a capacity reduction strategy look like. Our first step was identifying the goal, and the goal that we established was a reduction of 1,500 beds by December 31st, 2015. And for context, that represents around 18 to 20 nursing facilities in Oregon, and currently we have 12,200 beds. So that's the context for that. So in how do you get there? The bill establishes a system of incentives and disincentives to get there. The incentives are that we provide an augmented rate for nursing facilities that purchase other nursing facilities and agree to close that capacity. This is done under the oversight of the state through antitrust oversight from the state, where we'll be supervising all of these transactions. And that is the incentive side of this. The disincentive side is if the industry fails to hit the reduction target by December 31st, 2015, reduction or the reimbursement rates are reduced until such time as the reduction target is hit. There are also other policy things that are within this bill. Currently, a nursing facility can increase their capacity by the lesser of 10 beds or 10% every 2 years without having to go through a full certificate of need process. We work with the industry in generating a change to that language so that automatic increase goes away every 2 years. In exchange, our existing full certificate of need process, so if we have beds in South Salem, 80 nursing facility beds, and we simply want to relocate them to a brand new nursing facility bed without adding any additional capacity, that is currently taking a long time. And so the bill requires us or the state to complete those certificate of need reviews within 120 days. In summary, we think this is really good policy for Oregon. We think ultimately it's going to bend the cost curve for Medicaid nursing facility services that have been increasing over time. We think ultimately this is going to increase the quality of nursing facility services. The bill contains a provision where only facilities that have met quality standards are eligible from participating in this capacity reduction program. We think ultimately a lot of the outdated facilities will be replaced with more modern facilities, which will serve a higher skilled need that is needed in our market. And ultimately, we think that the reduction of nursing facility beds will lead to the development of more community-based resources, which is the hallmark of Oregon's long-term care system and something that we're always interested in achieving. So thank you for the opportunity to testify today. If they have any questions, I'm happy to answer.
Any questions?
Jim? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jim Carlson. I'm the president and CEO of the Oregon Healthcare Association. We represent 93% of the providers who operate skilled nursing facility beds in Oregon. We also represent over 400 assisted living residential care facilities, licensed in-home care providers, and independent senior housing providers. So we have a very broad and diverse membership that encompasses everyone from government-owned facilities like the State Veterans Home and in the Dalles or health districts all the way through to large multi-facility systems to small independent kind of mom and pop operators as well. So it's a very diverse group. What you have before you on House Bill 2056, and I submitted some testimony in advance, and on the first page I'm going to be working off of talks about what it does, and then I'm going to kind of follow through on that presentation. The bill was introduced at the request of the governor of the Department of Human Services, and it really does six things. The first thing that it does is it reauthorizes the current long-term care facility assessment and extends it to July
July 1st, 2020. The second thing that it does is that the revenues from the assessment is projected to increase approximately $110 million in other funds revenue this biennium. Along with associated federal matching funds, the provider assessment will generate its projected $295.4 million in total funds for this biennium, a little bit less than $300 million. And it's important to understand that roughly $300 million is assumed in the governor's recommended budget. So the DHS budget was built around an assumption that this assessment will be reauthorized, and if that does not happen, we're going to have a bit of a challenge on our hands down in Ways and Means we're going to all have to work hard on to address. The third thing it does, and this is probably the area that's going to get discussed in depth down in the Revenue Committee, but that some of you have heard about, is when this legislation was originally passed, this assessment in 2003, a very small, narrow carve-out was done for continuing care, retirement communities, and in order to offset those days and meet the very strict guidelines under federal law, you have to bring in a whole large volume of Medicaid days to offset those. So we've got roughly two dozen or so exempt facilities, and about a third of those are CCRCs that do not have Medicaid contracts. So that issue is something that, you might have heard something about. The rest of this is fairly straightforward. The fourth thing it does is it reauthorizes the current Medicaid payment methodology and establishes funding levels this biennium. And then the two issues I'm going to spend a little bit more time on delving into in the policy area here for the remainder of my testimony is that House Bill 2056 provides, as Mike indicated, a safe harbor under antitrust laws that would allow the state, DHS in this case, to be a convener of meetings at a local community level to bring different organizations and providers together who typically would be considered competitors, but the state could convene them in meetings and discuss what are their service area needs for skilled nursing services now and into the near-term foreseeable future, and are there ways and things that the state and the providers in that local service area can work together to make the system more efficient and to make the delivery system more cost-effective. And so it creates that safe harbor. And some of you will recall in the healthcare transformation legislation, we had a similar provision there that allowed the CCOs and hospitals and physicians and plans to come together under the Oregon Health Authority's auspices. The safe harbor antitrust exemption language in 2056 is quite a bit narrower than what was in the healthcare transformation legislation, and Representative Conger and I have spent quite a bit of time talking about this issue. This is a very focused, narrow safe harbor that is created to allow these conversations to happen, and as Mike already indicated, the state would have some incentives and disincentives to try to guarantee that we're going to get out-year cost savings on this if we don't hit all the capacity reduction targets that we have sought. The second page of my testimony, I'm not going to spend time on, but it gives you a section-by-section analysis of the Dash 1 amendments, and in the left-hand column, it labels whether that section is dealing with one of the policy issues, the revenue issues, or the budget side of this. So it's just kind of a simple key as you're going through the bill.
Yeah, this is going to revenue and Ways and Means.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. This will go to revenue and then it'll go to Ways and Means because it really, at the end of the day, has a lot of budget implications. There's a map you will see in your testimony here of the state of Oregon, and this is something that Mike's staff actually produced, and it graphically portrays where we have capacity, excess capacity issues in the state. It's a little hard to see, and I apologize if you've got eyes like mine that need glasses to see, but any of the orange or salmon-colored dots or yellow dots you see, those are all areas where we have facilities in the state operating at low census, low occupancy. Where you see blue dots and green dots, those are facilities that are 70 or 80% plus occupancy. So in those areas where you see a lot of the salmon, orange, or yellow dots grouped together, those are the service areas DHS is going to be targeting to try to convene stakeholder discussions. And when I say convene stakeholder discussions, please understand for a minute these discussions will be voluntary. voluntary. This would be a market-based kind of an approach the state is taking or proposing here. Nobody from the government will force anybody to do anything that they don't freely choose to do or decide to do on their own. The state is trying to do this with incentives and some disincentives, but convening those stakeholders will be designed to bring them together. To graphically portray for you, and I'm moving on to the bar charts and show you how this could save money very quickly, what you see on the first bar chart is a real service area in Oregon, and all the data that went into this came out of the audited Medicaid cost reports from last year. And you see four facilities that operate in the same service area that are all roughly at about 50% occupancy, and you see where they're at now and their average daily costs. If you were to execute successfully capacity reduction in that service area and consolidate those four facilities to two, what you would do in that service area is take your average occupancy level from about 50% in the service area up to 87.9%. Now, if you ask, great, what's the benefit of that? The benefit of that is the aggregate healthcare cost to deliver skilled nursing services in that community would go down by 8.4%. You would also still have additional capacity left to meet unmet needs into the future in that service area if you follow the data. So the good news on there is if you were able to successfully achieve the capacity reduction, there would be cost savings that in service area around the state would generate long-term cost savings. It would also make your provider community more financially viable into the future and allow things like Mr. McCormick talked about on things like improved quality and outcomes. I'm happy to conclude my testimony responding to questions, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
Thank you very much. Other questions? You've done a good job of briefing all of us individually, I think. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Can I have Arthur Towers and Ruth McEwen as the next panel, please? And remember, all we're talking about is the substance of the bill and the issue of CCRC will be dealt with in the Revenue Committee or the Ways and Means, probably in the Revenue Committee. You have that mic where? I think the mic's where.
Okay. Chair Greenlick, Committee. My name is Ruth McEwen. I am the Vice Chair of the Oregon Disabilities Commission. I am here to say that we are in support of House Bill 2056 and that the money that is coming through this bill would match what is in the governor's revised and recommended budget, and therefore we wholly support this and would recommend that you pass it.
Thank you very much.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Arthur Towers, Political Director for Service Employees Union Local 503. We represent about 1,500 workers in skilled nursing facilities across the state. We're the largest union in skilled nursing facilities. We also wanted to register our support for the legislation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, I have a bunch of other people signed up, but I'm suspecting that they want to deal with the CCRC issue. Let me read this list, and if any of you want to say something about this bill, come and join us. So I'll just start with the top. We have Ruth Gullius, I think. Is that right? Probably. Marilyn Webster, Marvin Webster. Robert Dwyer. Ray McGillery. Okay. Sam Farmer. Okay.
Chair Greenlink, all those folks were here to talk about the CCRC issue?
I thought so. Thank you, Bill. They'll have a shot at it in revenue. We have an amendment, which is basically the rewriting of the bill. The bill was a holding place. So if we have an amendment, a motion on the amendment, please.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment stated 2013.
Representative Kitty Guyer moves the Dash 1 amendment stated 2-2013 to House Bill 2056. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Any objection? We're talking about the Dash 1s now as 2026.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2056 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Representative Kenny Guyer moves House Bill 2056 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
I will be a no vote on this just to make sure that revenue knows we need to do something for the nonprofits that are providing these services and everything. Make sure that we look out for them as this bill goes through revenue.
You may want to let them know in a more direct way as well.
Okay.
Feeling on that. Okay. Please call the roll.
Representative Klim.
Aye.
Representative Conger.
Aye.
Representative Parker.
Aye.
Representative Hammer.
Aye.
Representative Wiley.
Aye.
Representative Weiner.
No.
Vice Chair Kenny Guyer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson.
Aye.
Chair Greenlee.
Aye. Motion passes and 2056 is on its way to the Revenue Committee. Don't need any carriers for anything today. Can I take a motion on... Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I move that we suspend the rules and let Representative Conger and Representative Widener vote on House Bill 3458.
Representative Thompson moves that we suspend the rules and allow Representative Conger and Representative Widener to vote on House Bill, which one is that?
3458.
Is there any objection? No. How do you vote? Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Okay, I'll close that work session. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 3128 and invite, will you tell us about it? And invite Ann Bazzini and Judy Meir. Here's to the podium.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3128 designates March of each year as Multiple Systems Atrophy Awareness Month.
I'm glad we got it. I was afraid we weren't going to get to this bill today.
Me too. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Ann Bazzini. I'm a legislative aide with State Representative Jack Reardon for House District 48. I'm here today on behalf of a constituent of ours who wrote a letter to the committee. She couldn't be here today, but she would like me to read it into the record. To the Oregon Legislature, my husband, Dr. John Bichelle, suffered from a very rare disease called multiple system atrophy. MSA is a progressive neurodegenerative disorder that affects all autonomic functions of the body. John was a well-liked and respected child psychologist and had been a vital part of the community until multiple system atrophy took away his ability to function as a normal human being. He had always worked in the public sector, first with the Multnomah County Mental Health and then with Clackamas County Mental Health Systems. He always felt working in the public sector was where he could do the most good for his entire community, much like all of you had chosen politics as your way to serve your communities. We had made so many plans, but having to retire at age 64 was not one of those. Dr. Bichelle loved his work. He was good at it. He helped everyone that crossed his path. But as his disease progressed, he realized he could no longer continue his passion of working with children as he had dedicated his life to do. Unfortunately, he was no match for multiple system atrophy. My husband was plagued with problems of balance. He felt lightheaded frequently and would pass out without warning as the autonomic functions of his body ceased to operate properly. He also suffered from double vision, slurred speech, swallowing problems, difficulty breathing, and bladder and bowel problems. In fact, every function of his, as well as those your body does on its own automatically, were affected. My husband and I didn't get to live out our plans. He didn't get to finish his work with children. He didn't get to enjoy his twilight years and revel in the work he had done during his lifetime. Instead, he had to spend his final days fighting the effects of MSA, knowing it was taking his life and that no one was able to do a single thing about it. You see, there is no cure for MSA. There are currently no treatments to delay the progress of the neurodegeneration in his brain. The only thing we can do is medicate patients of MSA, make them as comfortable as possible with the symptoms, and help them through their journey in this life with as much dignity and love as we can. It is my goal to educate others on this devastating disease and bring awareness so that we can find a cause and a cure. The lack of awareness about multiple system atrophy has hindered research funding. If this was like the swine flu and thousands could die from it, research would be more funded. Unlike the swine flu, it's not a matter of some could die from it. No one survives MSA. I would appreciate your support of this bill. Thank you, Charmaine Bichelle of Clackamas, Oregon.
Did she note how frequently this is, how frequent this disease is?
You know, she didn't, and I do have a little card from the National Institute of Health. I only had one copy, but if you would like it, I'm happy to leave it.
Does it talk about the incidence?
I believe it does.
It's a rare disorder.
Pardon me?
It's a rare disorder.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yeah. Introduce yourself, please.
I'm Judy Mears. My husband died of it also, and Charmaine was part of my support group. My husband died 11 years ago. But one of the reasons we want awareness is a lot of doctors don't even know what this is. You take your husband. It affects more men than women. But you take your significant other into the doctor, and quite often they don't know what they're dealing with. So I have written testimony too, but I'll just read the last part. Many doctors did not know what was causing his problem, and it took several years to find out what was happening. Some were diagnosed with Parkinson's and actually had MSA. One of the deciding factors is upon standing the sudden drop of one's blood pressure, and that causes them to pass out. But going to a doctor and having them take your blood pressure sitting down does not find the problem because it seems normal. So if Parkinson's medication is given, it's found not affected at all. Unfortunately, there's no known cure, but many of us have had our loved one's brain donated after death for research, which my husband did. And we hope to find a reason for the disorder and hopefully a cure so others do not have to slowly lose their autonomic system and end up in a wheelchair and then death. One usually dies within 7 to 10 years. I can't remember the exact like one in 100 or 1 in 1,000. I don't remember that. My husband's been gone 11 years this month. I'm still on the MSA website. And I get people calling from Washington and Oregon wanting information. And I had the, like I said, this support group in my home, and then OHSU asked if I would take it up there so more people could participate. And I was contacted 4 years ago to see if I could get it going again. But I gave them names of people who had been calling me, and so they did. They do have a support group up at OHSU for people who want to learn how to live with the disease, because one lady called and said, doctor says he's going to die, that's all there is to it, you know? She says, now how do we live with it? And I said, okay.
What department at OHSU does that?
Pardon?
No, I'm not about that, Doc. What department at OHSU handles the support?
The movement disorder.
Movement disorder.
Yes.
The same as Parkinson's.
Yeah.
It's an umbrella for a lot of those different diseases. It used to be known as Shy-Dräger, and it was named after Dr. Shy and Dr. Dräger, and I think in 1960, who discovered what was really happening. But like I said, the deciding factor is when they take the blood pressure, and if you're standing, it just goes down. And so people that have this, if they're standing in a line to go to a movie or something, and all of a sudden they're on the ground, like, you know, what happened? So, anyway, we would like to have an awareness, have it become more well-known.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
I'll close the public hearing.
Thank you for listening.
Thanks.
It's in the committee's agreement. We'll open a work session on House Bill 3128 and take a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3128 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Thompson moves House Bill 3128 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Is it supposed to go to Revenue and Ways and Means?
This is the only one we have today that's not going anywhere, I think.
I think you're reading the next slide.
Let me make sure that.
They put them below it, which means
it should be above it. And
yeah.
I think
somebody would get that fixed for us at some point.
Yeah. Well, let's
draw an arrow. Yeah.
3128. Yeah, 3128 does not have a subsequent.
It's about the same thing. So.
Okay. Would you please call the roll?
Representative Klim.
Excuse.
Representative Conger.
Aye.
Representative Harper.
Aye.
Representative Lively.
Aye.
Representative Kinnemer.
Aye.
Sorry, I can't read it.
Representative
Weidner. Aye. I had to pay attention.
Vice Chair Kinney-Geyer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson.
Aye.
And Chair Greenlight.
Aye. Motion carries. 3128 is on its way to the floor. Would Representative Reardon like to carry that? Okay. Representative Reardon will carry it.
Or is it just a feel-good?
Boy, we're done 5 minutes early.
March is the month.
I can imagine.
October 3rd is World.
You want to give us a preview? We're going to be really pretty busy from now on. We think we're going to be able to get everything done that we can by the 17th of.
But do you want us to hold that evening?
Of April. Still hold Monday evening just in case we.
Every Monday evening?
No, no, just that one, just in case we need to.
Healthcare will be done by April 18th.
Healthcare will be done with house bills by April 18th. There's still maybe something left to figure out how the system works, but I'm assuming the Senate bills will solve the rest of those problems.
What good could the Senate send us?
We are adjourned.
Same reason.
Yeah.